University of Cambridge International Examinations. International General Certificate of Secondary Education. November Examination Session 2006. English as a Second Language. Paper 4. Listening Comprehension. Welcome to the exam. In a moment, your teacher is going to give out the question papers. When you get your paper, fill in your center number, candidate number and name on the front page. Do not talk to anyone during the test. If you would like the tape to be louder, tell your teacher now. The tape will not be stopped while you are doing the test. Teacher, please give out the question papers, and when all the candidates are ready to start the test, please turn the tape back on. Now you are all ready, here is the test. Look at the questions for part one. There are six questions in this part of the exam. For each question, you will hear the situation described as it is on your exam paper. You will hear each question twice. Part one, questions 1 to 6. For questions 1 to 6, you will hear a series of short sentences. Answer each question on the line provided. Your answer should be as brief as possible. You will hear each item twice. Question 1. Aisha wants to improve her computer skills. What special offer is available to her at the college?
I've been told that you offer computer training in the college here.
That's right. You can come in and have a free lesson for up to 3 hours at any time convenient to you.
I've been told that you offer computer training in the college here.
That's right. You can come in and have a free lesson for up to 3 hours at any time convenient to you.
Question 2. How does Hamad obtain a reduction on the tickets? Give 2 details.
2 special price student tickets, please.
I'm afraid I can't give you the 20% reduction unless you prove that you are students.
Here are our library cards, which show the name of our college.
Yes, but I also need something showing your photos.
Fine. Here are our passports, too.
Thank you. That'll be £5, please.
Two special price student tickets, please.
I'm afraid I can't give you the 20% reduction unless you prove that you are students.
Here are our library cards, which show the name of our college.
Yes, but I also need something showing your photos.
Fine. Here are our passports, too.
Thank you. That'll be £5, please.
Question 3. Why is it difficult for Tandy to reach the bank?
Excuse me, I need to change some money. Where's the nearest bank, please?
There's one over there on the other side of the main road, but there are 8 lanes of busy traffic, so you need to cross by the subway. It's over there. Look, it goes under the road.
Excuse me, I need to change some money. Where's the nearest bank, please?
There's one over there on the other side of the main road, but there are 8 lanes of busy traffic, so you need to cross by the subway. It's over there. Look, it goes under the road.
Question 4. Why should the singers walk to the concert, and at what time will they rehearse before it?
Listen, everybody. The choir will be singing next Saturday at 6 p.m. in a concert at the Town Theatre. You'll need to make your own way there. We are not hiring a coach for you this time, as this is a local event.
Will there be refreshments available?
Yes, there should be, during the interval, which is scheduled for 7:30. Oh, and we need to meet on the theatre steps at 4 o'clock for a rehearsal in advance, please. Listen, everybody. The choir will be singing next Saturday at 6 p.m. in a concert at the Town Theatre. You'll need to make your own way there. We are not hiring a coach for you this time, as this is a local event.
Will there be refreshments available?
Yes, there should be, during the interval, which is scheduled for 7:30. Oh, and we need to meet on the theatre steps at 4 o'clock for a rehearsal in advance, please.
Question 5. Why doesn't Sonia's computer printer work?
I can't make the printer print my essay. Whatever's wrong with it?
Perhaps it's run out of paper.
I've just put a fresh supply of paper in. Oh, I see. It's not connected to the computer. I can't make the printer print my essay. Whatever's wrong with it?
Perhaps it's run out of paper.
I've just put a fresh supply of paper in. Oh, I see. It's not connected to the computer.
Question 6. Which of the two bargains does Daniel decide on?
I like these jeans. And they're cheaper than next door at that new clothing shop. I can use my student discount card here too. 10% reduction.
Yes, Daniel, but they were on a buy one pair, get one pair free deal there. So you'd have two pairs from the new shop for little more than the price of one pair from this shop.
You're right. And I'm desperately in need of new jeans. I'll go back to the other shop. I like these jeans, and they're cheaper than next door at that new clothing shop. I can use my student discount card here too. 10% reduction.
Yes, Daniel, but they were on a buy one pair, get one pair free deal there. So you'd have two pairs from the new shop for little more than the price of one pair from this shop.
You're right, and I'm desperately in need of new jeans. I'll go back to the other shop.
That is the last question in part one. In a moment, you will hear part two. Now look at the questions for part two, exercise one. Part 2. Part 2, Exercise 1, Question 7. Listen to the following interview with a rug maker, and then fill in the details below. You will hear the interview twice.
Good evening. Tonight, we are at the Bahtiyar Carpet Gallery in Turkey, where rug maker Saida Sadi is going to tell us all about rugs and their history. Welcome to the programme.
Thank you. Welcome to our gallery. We have rooms and rooms of carpets and rugs. Some are new and some are antiques. Our most valuable items are over 100 years old.
100 years? That sounds like a very long time for a rug to last. My carpets at home wear out after just a few years, and I have to buy new ones.
Ah, that's because you buy cheaper carpets, which are produced for the mass market. The rugs we sell here are quite different.
Tell us about your fine rugs. Well, before you do, let's start with the difference between a carpet and a rug.
The only real difference is size. Rugs are usually small enough to hang on the wall, up to 2 meters long, while anything larger is usually referred to as a carpet.
I see. So, how do we tell the difference between the types of rug available? How could I find out the history of a particular rug?
Most rugs can be identified by their place of origin or by the family or tribe that made them.
So they're named after their makers, then?
Yes, that's right. You've heard of Kazakh rugs from Kazakhstan. To recognise one of them, for example, we need to consider the colours, patterns and way of weaving used in the making of the rug.
So how is a rug made?
Well, first comes the basic material of a rug. This is called the warp and weft, and is usually made of wool, cotton or silk. The best quality wool used in the best rugs is smooth, soft and shiny. Cheaper wool is rougher to the touch. The type of knot used to put all this together identifies where the rug was made and reflects its quality. The more fine the knots, the better the rug. Two types of knots are commonly used in good quality rug making, what we often call Turkish knots and Persian knots. You can tell if the rug has been made by hand or machine by looking carefully at the knots. Machining produces loops on the back of the rug, but actual knots prove that the rug was handmade.
I see. What else is important in identifying the history of a particular rug?
Colour. The best colours for a good quality rug are made from natural dyes. These will be made from vegetables or from insects.
I think of traditional rugs as being mainly blue and red.
Quite so. Warm red colours are usually produced from plant dyes, but crimson, that very bright red, comes from chenille. Chenille is an insect dye, and this means that the rug was made after 1850, as that was when that dye was introduced to the places in the world where rug making is most important.
I suppose chemical dyes are modern.
Yes. Any chemically produced colour means the rug would be made in the 20th or 21st century.
I think it's really interesting to be able to find out so much about the rug you are buying.
It certainly is. Did you know that many old rugs have a date and signature to show which family made them?
Like an artist's signature on a painting?
Yes, and a really top quality rug has its pattern on the reverse as well as on the front.
So now I have a checklist of details helping me to identify rugs. Many thanks, Saeed Asadi, for talking to me.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Good evening. Tonight, we are at the Bahtiyar Carpet Gallery in Turkey, where rug maker Saeed Asadi is going to tell us all about rugs and their history. Welcome to the programme.
Thank you. Welcome to our gallery. We have rooms and rooms of carpets and rugs. Some are new and some are antiques. Our most valuable items are over 100 years old.
100 years? That sounds like a very long time for a rug to last. My carpets at home wear out after just a few years, and I have to buy new ones.
That's because you buy cheaper carpets, which are produced for the mass market. The rugs we sell here are quite different.
Tell us about your fine rugs. Well, before you do, let's start with the difference between a carpet and a rug.
The only real difference is size. Rugs are usually small enough to hang on the wall, up to 2 meters long, while anything larger is usually referred to as a carpet.
I see. So how do we tell the difference between the types of rug available? How could I find out the history of a particular rug?
Most rugs can be identified by their place of origin or by the family or tribe that made them.
So they're named after their makers, then?
Yes, that's right. You've heard of Kazakh rugs from Kazakhstan. To recognise one of them, for example, we need to consider the colours, patterns and way of weaving used in the making of the rug.
So how is a rug made?
Well, first comes the basic material of a rug. This is called the warp and weft, and is usually made of wool, cotton or silk. The best quality wool used in the best rugs is smooth, soft and shiny. Cheaper wool is rougher to the touch. The type of knot used to put all this together identifies where the rug was made and reflects its quality. The more fine the knots, the better the rug. Two types of knots are commonly used in good quality rug making, what we often call Turkish knots and Persian knots. You can tell if the rug has been made by hand or machine by looking carefully at the knots. Machining produces loops on the back of the rug, but actual knots prove that the rug was handmade.
I see. What else is important in identifying the history of a particular rug?
Colour. The best colours for a good quality rug are made from natural dyes. These would be made from vegetables or from insects.
I think of traditional rugs as being mainly blue and red.
Quite so. Warm red colours are usually produced from plant dyes, but crimson, that very bright red, comes from chenille. Chenille is an insect dye, and this means that the rug was made after 1850, as that was when that dye was introduced to the places in the world where rug making is most important.
I suppose chemical dyes are modern.
Yes. Any chemically produced colour means the rug would be made in the 20th or 21st century.
I think it's really interesting to be able to find out so much about the rug you are buying.
It certainly is. Did you know that many old rugs have a date and signature to show which family made them?
Like an artist's signature on a painting?
Yes, and a really top quality rug has its pattern on the reverse as well as on the front.
So now I have a checklist of details helping me to identify rugs. Many thanks, Saeed Asadi, for talking to me.
That is the end of Part 2, Exercise 1. In a moment, you will hear Part 2, Exercise 2. Now look at the questions for Exercise 2. Part 2. Part 2, Exercise 2, Question 8. Listen to the following interview with a former salesman who has recently become a famous singer, and then fill in the details below. You will hear the interview twice.
Good evening, and welcome to Arts Hour. In the studio with me today is Luigi Rigoletti, the new voice who has reached the top of the international classical music chart with his own version of the famous piece, Nessun Dorma. Luigi, before we review some of your music, could you tell us what is so unusual about your singing career?
Certainly. I'm 39 years old, and until last year, I was a travelling salesman. In fact, that was my job for 15 years.
So, how have you suddenly become a singer? A household name.
Well, I knew I had a good voice. When I was a child, people always commented how well I was able to sing. My relatives always said, "You should do something with your lovely voice." I loved singing and enjoyed opera, as my parents always listened to it at home. So it was always on in the background when I was growing up.
Did you know you were going to be a singer?
Oh, no. I just thought I had been blessed with a good voice. And the opportunity did not arise for me to have any voice training as a young person.
So, why did you change from salesman to singer?
I was bored with my job and needed a challenge. By complete chance, I found a singing tutor.
Did your teacher give you self-confidence?
Absolutely. She was amazed when I first sang and praised my tenor voice and told me to use it. I still can't believe it, really.
How did you become famous, then?
Well, I simply entered amateur singing competitions and won everything. Then, in the year 2000, I entered a Millennium Festival event and won my class. That was the biggest international contest of the year. I knew then that I could sing professionally.
So, did you sing and sell at the same time?
Actually, I lost my salesman's job last year. Yes, I had been doing both jobs at once. Selling during the day and singing engagements in the evening and at weekends. When I was made redundant, I was given some compensation money, and that has helped me to become a full-time singer. I am, of course, selling my singing talent now, so it is the same skill as being a salesman. Also, I travel even more extensively now than I ever did when I was a salesman.
So, how did you begin as a full-time singer?
I sang at minor football matches and gradually progressed to national and international matches.
What sort of music do you prefer to sing?
A mixture. Easy listening, really. I try to make classics more accessible for the average person, like myself.
Have you got lots of future bookings?
Yes, for the whole of the next football season. And I am going to record a CD with our national orchestra too. I'm also booked for some big concerts in Johannesburg, London, New Delhi, and Tokyo.
And how about your family? What do they think about your sudden rise to fame?
They are really proud of me, and I couldn't do it without their support and understanding. It's a dream come true.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Good evening, and welcome to Arts Hour. In the studio with me today is Luigi Rigoletti, the new voice who has reached the top of the international classical music chart with his own version of the famous piece, Nessun Dorma. Luigi, before we review some of your music, could you tell us what is so unusual about your singing career?
Certainly. I'm 39 years old, and until last year, I was a travelling salesman. In fact, that was my job for 15 years.
So, how have you suddenly become a singer, a household name?
Well, I knew I had a good voice. When I was a child, people always commented how well I was able to sing. My relatives always said, "You should do something with your lovely voice." I loved singing, and enjoyed opera, as my parents always listened to it at home, so it was always on in the background when I was growing up.
Did you know you were going to be a singer?
Oh, no. I just thought I had been blessed with a good voice, and the opportunity did not arise for me to have any voice training as a young person.
So, why did you change from salesman to singer?
I was bored with my job and needed a challenge. By complete chance, I found a singing tutor.
Did your teacher give you self-confidence?
Absolutely. She was amazed when I first sang and praised my tenor voice and told me to use it. I still can't believe it, really.
How did you become famous, then?
Well, I simply entered amateur singing competitions and won everything. Then, in the year 2000, I entered a Millennium Festival event and won my class. That was the biggest international contest of the year. I knew then that I could sing professionally.
So, did you sing and sell at the same time?
Actually, I lost my salesman's job last year. Yes, I had been doing both jobs at once. Selling during the day and singing engagements in the evening and at weekends. When I was made redundant, I was given some compensation money, and that has helped me to become a full-time singer. I am, of course, selling my singing talent now, so it is the same skill as being a salesman. Also, I travel even more extensively now than I ever did when I was a salesman.
So, how did you begin as a full-time singer?
I sang at minor football matches and gradually progressed to national and international matches.
What sort of music do you prefer to sing?
A mixture. Easy listening, really. I try to make classics more accessible for the average person, like myself.
Have you got lots of future bookings?
Yes, for the whole of the next football season. And I am going to record a CD with our national orchestra too. I'm also booked for some big concerts in Johannesburg, London, New Delhi and Tokyo.
And how about your family? What do they think about your sudden rise to fame?
They are really proud of me, and I couldn't do it without their support and understanding. It's a dream come true.
That is the end of part two. In a moment you will hear part three. Now look at the questions for part three, exercise one. Part 3. Part 3, Exercise 1. Question 9. Listen to the following interview about the benefits of sunlight to our health, and then answer the questions below. You will hear the interview twice.
Good evening and welcome to our weekly programme, Your Health. Our subject tonight is light. Many people agree that light relieves a number of illnesses and that it's as vital to us as our vitamins derived from food sources. Our expert, Dr. Velma Gilbert, is here to explain this to us. Good evening, Dr. Gilbert.
Good evening. Yes, it's true that more exposure to sunlight can make us feel better. Light on our skin and in our eyes helps our bodies to function better.
Often people are too worried about the adverse effects of sunlight, though. You know, skin cancer, sunstroke, migraine, headaches, eye problems.
Yes, but we need sunlight for our health as well. Enough hours of bright light will help to activate our hormones and neurotransmitters.
What are they?
The nerve message carriers in our bodies. Also, of course, the ultraviolet light in sunlight enables our skin to produce vitamin D.
Vitamin D? That's good for strengthening teeth and bones, isn't it?
Yes, indeed. So we all need more light in our lives.
How do we achieve that, then?
Make sure you go outside in bright daylight. If you work in an office or at college all day, make sure you go outside during your breaks. Eat your lunch outside. Take your break time cup of tea out with you and take a walk in your afternoon break.
But in some parts of the world, many of us arrive for school or work in the dark and leave in the dark.
Well, maybe it's not actually totally dark. Even if it's overcast or cloudy or raining, go outside. You'll feel much better for it. Half an hour of light, even in winter, is enough for your skin to make the vitamin D necessary for the body, even if you are wrapped up in winter clothes and scarves and only your face is in the sunlight.
Thank you. That is good practical advice. Do you have any other suggestions for bringing light into our lives?
You could get some different light bulbs for your house. In some countries, you can buy daylight lamps. These lamps are much brighter than usual household lights, and produce the strength and brightness of actual daylight.
Anything else?
You could try putting a blue bulb in one of your lamps. It's supposed to make you feel calm and relaxed. And you can even buy what is called a light box now for therapeutic use. It emits really bright light. Really good in countries with few daylight hours.
Thank you so much for all your advice and suggestions, helping us all to light up our lives.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Good evening and welcome to our weekly programme, Your Health. Our subject tonight is light. Many people agree that light relieves a number of illnesses and that it's as vital to us as our vitamins derived from food sources. Our expert, Dr. Velma Gilbert, is here to explain this to us. Good evening, Dr. Gilbert.
Good evening. Yes, it's true that more exposure to sunlight can make us feel better. Light on our skin and in our eyes helps our bodies to function better.
Often people are too worried about the adverse effects of sunlight, though. You know, skin cancer, sunstroke, migraine, headaches, eye problems.
Yes, but we need sunlight for our health as well. Enough hours of bright light will help to activate our hormones and neurotransmitters.
What are they?
The nerve message carriers in our bodies. Also, of course, the ultraviolet light in sunlight enables our skin to produce vitamin D.
Vitamin D? That's good for strengthening teeth and bones, isn't it?
Yes, indeed. So we all need more light in our lives.
How do we achieve that, then?
Make sure you go outside in bright daylight. If you work in an office or at college all day, make sure you go outside during your breaks. Eat your lunch outside. Take your break time cup of tea out with you and take a walk in your afternoon break.
But in some parts of the world, many of us arrive for school or work in the dark and leave in the dark.
Well, maybe it's not actually totally dark. Even if it's overcast or cloudy or raining, go outside. You'll feel much better for it. Half an hour of light, even in winter, is enough for your skin to make the vitamin D necessary for the body, even if you are wrapped up in winter clothes and scarves and only your face is in the sunlight.
Thank you. That is good practical advice. Do you have any other suggestions for bringing light into our lives?
You could get some different light bulbs for your house. In some countries, you can buy daylight lamps. These lamps are much brighter than usual household lights and produce the strength and brightness of actual daylight.
Anything else?
You could try putting a blue bulb in one of your lamps. It's supposed to make you feel calm and relaxed. And you can even buy what is called a light box now for therapeutic use. It emits really bright light. Really good in countries with few daylight hours.
Thank you so much for all your advice and suggestions, helping us all to light up our lives.
That is the end of Part 3, Exercise 1. In a moment, you will hear Exercise 2. Now look at the questions for Exercise 2. Part 3. Part 3, Exercise 2. Question 10. Listen to the following talk by a college professor about the reduction in the number of people reading books, and then answer the questions below. You will hear the talk twice.
Society today generally claims that young people are even better educated than they were in previous generations. But how can this be the case when we know that people read much less now than they did even just 20 years ago? It's an issue I'm very concerned about. Outwardly, it appears that the frequency and standard of reading is fine. There are lots of bookshops in the streets of the big cities, and more books are sold than ever before. People read on the bus, tram, train, and plane. Or do they? Well, evidence from a new investigation just carried out by the ABC Foundation, an international arts group, proves that fewer people are reading books than in the past, particularly books that are works of literature. This same research group also carried out similar surveys 10 and 20 years ago, so it's simple to compare results across time. The investigation has worried people so much that a special study called Reading at Risk has been written to draw attention to the problems and to create public awareness about the drop in numbers of people reading in the world today. Apparently, over the past 20 years, the proportion of 18 to 34-year-olds reading regularly has fallen by 28%. In previous generations, this is the age group thought most likely to read literature, whether for study or pleasure. Now they are much less likely to pick up a novel and read it. This general pattern follows to a lesser extent throughout adult society, according to the results of the survey. So what could be the cause for this decline in reading? The Reading at Risk study identifies the internet as the primary cause. Some college staff think that the decline has happened because our cultural and educational climates don't give books the respect they deserve. Often today, students are not expected to read whole books. It's considered too difficult. Instead, they are just instructed to focus on a chapter. But I want to argue that books are important in their own right, because book reading contributes to the flourishing of a society. The Reading at Risk study indicates that readers play an active role in their communities. So the decline in book reading means this affects participation in social activities within the community. That's why the encouragement of book reading is a cause worthy of our wholehearted support.
Now you will hear the talk again.
Society today generally claims that young people are even better educated than they were in previous generations. But how can this be the case when we know that people read much less now than they did even just 20 years ago? It's an issue I'm very concerned about. Outwardly, it appears that the frequency and standard of reading is fine. There are lots of bookshops in the streets of the big cities, and more books are sold than ever before. People read on the bus, tram, train, and plane. Or do they? Well, evidence from a new investigation just carried out by the ABC Foundation, an international arts group, proves that fewer people are reading books than in the past, particularly books that are works of literature. This same research group also carried out similar surveys 10 and 20 years ago, so it's simple to compare results across time. The investigation has worried people so much that a special study called Reading at Risk has been written to draw attention to the problems and to create public awareness about the drop in numbers of people reading in the world today. Apparently, over the past 20 years, the proportion of 18 to 34-year-olds reading regularly has fallen by 28%. In previous generations, this is the age group thought most likely to read literature, whether for study or pleasure. Now they are much less likely to pick up a novel and read it. This general pattern follows to a lesser extent throughout adult society, according to the results of the survey. So, what could be the cause for this decline in reading? The Reading at Risk study identifies the internet as the primary cause. Some college staff think that the decline has happened because our cultural and educational climates don't give books the respect they deserve. Often today, students are not expected to read whole books. It's considered too difficult. Instead, they are just instructed to focus on a chapter. But I want to argue that books are important in their own right, because book reading contributes to the flourishing of a society. The Reading at Risk study indicates that readers play an active role in their communities. So the decline in book reading means this affects participation in social activities within the community. That's why the encouragement of book reading is a cause worthy of our wholehearted support.
That is the end of part three, and of the test. In a moment, your teacher will stop the tape and collect your papers. Please check that you have written your name, centre number, and candidate number on the front of your question paper. Remember, you must not talk until all the papers have been collected. Teacher, the tape should now be stopped and all papers collected. Thank you, everyone.